From the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, a look at what films and filmmakers are getting award season love and which ones not so much. Then, while making an audiobook about women's history, comedy writer Miro Marco found it a lot harder to find humor than she thought it would be.
I just hadn't really studied women's history per se, and when I did start reading it in detail, I was stunned at how much worse it was than what I thought. I thought I was going to read about drudgery.
And the country swing band Asleep at the Wheel is still rolling along 50 years after its founding. All that coming up on The Frame.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Warner Brothers Pictures, presenting the emotionally authentic A Star is Born, directed by Bradley Cooper, starring Cooper, Lady Gaga, and Sam Elliott, for consideration in all categories.
In Fox Searchlight, presenting The Favorite, winner of the Golden Globe for Best Actress Olivia Colman, and nominated for a leading 14 Critics' Choice Awards. Awards eligible in all categories.
Welcome to The Frame. I'm John Horn. It's pretty easy to see award season in Hollywood as a self-indulgent reason for the industry to get dressed up and congratulate itself. But as the past years have shown, the public platform of these events can highlight some real socio-political issues. The Oscars So White campaign, started by the cultural critic April Rain, furthered a public conversation about representation. And at last year's Golden Globes, activists for women's rights accompanied actresses on the red carpet. This week, the members of the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences began voting on what movies to nominate for this year's Oscars. So to get a read on what narratives this award season has, I sat down with Kyle Buchanan of the New York Times.
I really believe since they've expanded that Best Picture category past five nominees, you get a fantastic look at the year. You know, you have the superhero film Black Panther, you have the Netflix film Roma, you have movies by Spike Lee, you have a Bohemian Rhapsody, which is almost certainly going to set off a wave of music biopic imitators. And yet, you can also tell you something about that year generally, not just the movie year, and not just the year in pop culture, but the year. And I do feel that when we have conversations about movies like Green Book and Bohemian Rhapsody, about screen representation, it is reflecting how we feel about ourselves and how we feel represented or not by the world, by politics, by the systems that govern us.
And the other thing that I think is worth noting, too, is that sometimes movies can benefit or be derailed by things that happen outside of the film itself. And that really seems to be happening right now around Green Book. There was a complaint by a niece of Don Shirley about whether or not the film was accurate or whether or not it depicted her uncle in a favorable light. And now there's been more stuff that has come out about the co-screenwriter of the film that feels to me could be potentially fatal.
So if people aren't familiar, Green Book, it's with Viggo Mortensen, Mahershala Ali. It is a fact-based movie, sort of a reverse Driving Miss Daisy. You know, John was saying that some stuff has come to light. Yeah, that the son of the subject of the film who co-wrote the screenplay, he had a tweet. he was tweeting at Donald Trump about Muslims and 9/11 in a way that is ironic that when you realize Mahershala Ali, who is so fantastic in that film, is Muslim himself.
It's not just ironic, it's wrong,
because
he was saying that Muslims were applauding on 9/11, which is factually untrue.
And also Peter Farrelly, the director of the film, people were recirculating an old interview with him where he talked about exposing himself to Cameron Diaz, to other people in the industry, as a joke, framed as a joke, but something that he said he's done hundreds of times, which, you know, was not as well received as a joke, let's say, right now, given everything going on in the world.
Let's talk about where we are in the calendar. Nomination voting for the Academy Awards opened on January 7th. It closes on Monday, January 14th. The nominations come out on January 22nd. The Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences, thanks to a very aggressive campaign to diversify and grow the membership, is now more than 9,000 members. But if you look at the other guilds that have made their nominations so far, the Producers Guild of America, the Writers Guild of America, the Directors Guild of America, and the Screen Actors Guild, AFTRA, there's more than Academy voters represented in those picks and those voters. What do those guilds tell us now about the kinds of movies that seem to be connecting? And on the worst part of that equation, the movies that you and I might love that don't seem to be.
Well, they paint a rosy picture for a few movies. A Star is Born and Black Klansman both have popped up at just about every single guild. I think actually every single guild that they're able to. Films like Roma and Vice are also doing well. Something that surprises me, though, John, is that Black Panther, an immediately iconic film, probably the most landmark film released this year, and a critically well-reviewed one, the third biggest movie domestically of all time, $1 billion grosser. While it is in the Oscar race, it's not doing that sort of gangbusters business that I might have expected from the precursors. And the one that's often left out that surprises me is the director, Ryan Coogler. Truly, I can't think of a more promising young director. He's 32, has directed three films, Fruitvale Station, Creed, and Black Panther. That is an arc that is incredible, indelible, unrefutable. And for him not to necessarily be picking up the best director accolades from groups like the DGA or even the Golden Globes is surprising to me. And I don't know what people are waiting for. Are they waiting for him to make his next movie and then, you know, they'll add, you know, his chips from Black Panther to that bit instead? Why would you not do it now when you have in front of you this incredibly promising young man who's made one of the biggest films of all time?
And if you look at the selections for the Directors Guild of America that not only did feature, but also first feature, not a woman among the 10 nominees.
Yeah, not a woman among them. I mean, this is obviously a topic that we talk about all the time, not just on The Frame, but fortunately, we're starting to have this conversation in many more places, in the media, in public, the studios are having them. And yet, John, oh man, progress can feel so slow at times. I was looking at how many female-directed movies are coming out this summer from big studios, and there are maybe fewer than three.
Yeah, and I can think of a couple really good movies that were directed by women this past year. I would put Karin Kusama's Destroyer, a movie I really liked, Marielle Heller's Can You Ever Forgive Me? I don't know what you would add to that list.
I mean, my two favorite movies of 2018 were Deborah Granik's Leave No Trace and Chloe Zhao's The Writer. I mean, even talking about these movies, I was watching someone watch The Writer on the plane recently, watching over their shoulder. I started crying just watching them watch it.
Kyle, great to see you.
Great to see you as always.
Kyle Buchanan is my favorite awards pundit. He is the Carpetbagger columnist for the New York Times. Coming up on The Frame, two female comedians find some humor, just a little, in the indignities of being a woman.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Warner Brothers Pictures, presenting the emotionally authentic A Star is Born, directed by Bradley Cooper. Starring Cooper, Lady Gaga, and Sam Elliott, AFI calls the film a stellar achievement in its own universe, and Owen Gleiberman of Variety calls it an emotional knockout. Nominated for 4 SAG Awards, including Outstanding Performance by a Cast, Best Actor, Best Actress, and Best Supporting Actor, for consideration in all categories, including Best Picture and Best Director. And Fox Searchlight Pictures, presenting The Favorite, winner of the Golden Globe for Best Actress Olivia Colman, and nominated for a leading 14 Critics' Choice Awards, including Lead Actress Olivia Colman, Supporting Actresses Emma Stone and Rachel Weisz, Acting Ensemble, Original Screenplay, Editing, Production Design, Costume Design, Cinematography, Director Yorgos Lanthimos, and Best Picture of the Year. Awards eligible in all categories.
Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Thanks for joining us. The audiobook, The Indignities of Being a Woman, is written and performed by comedians Meryl Marco and Megan Keister. Marco, who's 70 years old, is an Emmy-winning TV writer with credits going back to the 1970s comedy show Laugh-In'. Her longest television gig was on The David Letterman Show, where she was the first head writer back when women were almost non-existent in late-night writers' rooms. Marco is also the author of a number of books, including Cool, Calm, and Contentious. Keister is in her 30s and makes a living as a writer while doing stand-up. On her personal blog, The Inoffensive Comedian, she's written about her efforts to report on Louis C.K.'s history of sexual misconduct. For their audiobook, The Indignities of Being a Woman, Keister researched women's modern-day history, while Marco took on the long-ago eras. The book details some grim realities, which are handled with a mixture of wit and despair. When I talked with Marco and Keister last year, soon after the book was released, Marco explained how the book evolved from its original idea after the 2017 Women's March.
I think because of the Women's March and because of the Me Too thing, we went from talking about just the impossibility of the expectations put on women to how historically obstacles have been put in the way of women that I really never realized particularly were there. I mean, I just hadn't really studied women's history per se. And when I did start reading it in detail, I was stunned at how much worse it was than what I thought. I thought I was going to read about drudgery, not slavery and and really no kind of personhood or citizenship or anything.
Yeah.
I mean, way worse than I thought.
And I was also, I mean, I'm of the generation that was raised to believe that Meryl's generation had fixed everything for women.
Well, you know, I was of the generation that thought Meryl's generation fixed everything. I was stunned to find out we hadn't. I thought we had, you know, it slid backwards again and turned back into what it used to be, sort of, only with better language skills. That was really surprising to me.
You talk about how things certainly have been worse, even if they're not very good right now, Meryl. Let's play a clip from your chapter about crime.
Which brings us to the golden precious 500 years of witch trials and torture across Europe and Scandinavia, where all it took to be a woman in crime was scolding, nagging, or threatening your husband. In fact, this was such a faux pas that in Scotland in the mid-1500s, during what I'm guessing was a slow period for innovation, they invented a form of punishment exclusively for ladies they called a scold's bridle. A scold being a term given to a woman described as a nag or a shrew whose talk was judged inappropriate or rude. The iron scold's bridle resembled a muzzle with a padlock at the rear and a projecting spike that went inside the mouth when closed.
I mean, there's the horror of picturing this, and then there's the horror of realizing that women today are muzzled. It's not quite as graphic and not quite as obvious, but even though the device has gone away, the circumstances remain.
Yeah, I don't know any women who weren't immensely triggered, and I hate to use that word, but it seems to be the word that explains what I'm going to say, that Kavanaugh trial. I mean, the fact that Dr. Blasey Ford was so intelligent and obviously she was so clearly telling the truth, and then it wound up being a thing that the president and others made fun of. It's just, you know, there aren't words for how horrible that is.
I want to read from a review of the book on the Audible site. It was written by a woman named Megan, but Megan C., not Megan K., so I don't think it was written by you, Megan. And she said, and I'm quoting now, "Ultimately, I hated this book, again, not for the material itself or the presentation, but what it represents because of how it boldly addresses something that still happens in modern society," unquote. And she gave it 5 out of 5 stars.
Nice. Thanks, Megan. Us Megan's got to look out for
But her. I think she's onto something, that this is a book that really does make you angry, even if you like what it's saying.
Mm-hmm. No, that was our intent, definitely, is to get people fired up, let's say.
Also, just the fact that that I was walking around this world after thinking for my entire adult life and didn't know this stuff seemed ridiculous to me. That it seemed like something that all women should know, in terms of when you're fighting any battle now, just know what you've been up against and how it colors what you're fighting right now.
We're talking with Meryl Marco and Megan Keister about their audiobook, The Indignities of Being a Woman. There are some areas in the book where things for women were actually better not that long ago. I want to play a section from your chapter about entertainment.
I didn't know that from 1900 to the early 20s, half the movies made in the U.S. were written by women. I didn't know the first film to feature a plot, 1896's The Cabbage Fairy, was directed by a woman. I didn't know the first film editor was a woman. I didn't know that between 1930 and 1950, over 40% of film industry employees were women. I didn't know the egalitarianism of the early film business caused the writer Julie Hunt to declare in 1939, quote, "This industry is a generation ahead of the rest of the world in its attitude toward women workers," unquote.
Yeah, that didn't last, did it?
No.
You know what? It's amazing that I learned just yesterday when I participated in a documentary on the history of late night programming. The first late night program, women were often first and then just somehow shoved aside, like what Megan just talked about. The first late night programming in television was a woman named Faye Emerson, who did hundreds of shows. They have kinescopes of them now, which I guess they're going to put in this documentary, but I had no idea.
So why aren't those people well known? Why is that history of Hollywood and entertainment forgotten so quickly?
Well, I mean, I always joke that history is written by the winners and herstory is written by the losers.
Yeah, you know, and then there's just the fact that there were women, for instance, painting during the Renaissance, but men were creating history. So they just didn't include them when they did written history.
Yeah.
The same is true of the ancient Greeks and Romans. It wasn't like there were no women or any women who were doing anything. They were just not included in the history.
Yeah. The people who are in control are the ones who dictate the narrative.
I think one of the subtle ways that indignity happens is the way that people are defined in relation to the people they work with. And Meryl, even though you have your own great body of work, if people look you up on Google, you come up as somebody who worked with David Letterman as his first head writer, that you are defined by the man you used to work with as opposed to your own talents and own history and own resume. Is that in and of itself an indignity?
Yes. Yes, it's been making me crazy for the entirety of my life.
Well, and yeah, the way that Meryl and I met is I reached out to her because I wanted to profile her. I wanted to write about her because I feel like she's never been given the due that she should be given because she's one of the best comedy writers of all time. And
well, thank you.
And you like dogs and an additional thing. But yeah, I mean, that's actually the catalyst of what brought us together. She would never let me write about her, but now we wrote something together. So
there's so much history in this book, but it also reminds, I think, anybody who reads it or I guess listens to it about what's happening today. And Megan, I want to ask you about something you've done because you've written about your efforts to ask comedians about Louis C.K.'s long, but at the time, not public history of sexual misconduct. And here's what you wrote about talking to comedians at the Just for Laughs Festival in Montreal 3 years ago when festival head Bruce Wills approached you. "Were I to ask the offending question again," he said, "I would be ejected from the carpet. But if I asked nice questions, I would be allowed to stay." And all I could think of, this is how it keeps happening. You can't challenge what you know to be true.
Correct. Yes. Yeah. I mean, and that's why those, you know, men got away with all those things they did for so long is because of power dynamics, basically, because there were people protecting them.
And also the women around those men, I'm speaking from my own experience, were taught to believe that if you put up with a lot of bad behavior, you were being a good sport.
Incorrect belief that, yeah, if you not like other girls, your way into putting your head in the sand and ignoring things like this will result in him taking pity on you and not treating you with the same misogyny that he treats every other woman is so.
Yeah, you'd be the exceptional girl. Yeah. That's a thing I read about a lot now, the phrase the exceptional girl, and that was a big thing.
Which means what?
Trying to be the exceptional girl, like not identify with the wide birth of women that exist, but you be the one exception to every rule.
Yeah, you're throwing your whole gender under the bus for fun and profit, I guess.
You are addressing some very difficult and very serious subjects in this book. How would you describe the tone? Because I think it is funny, even though we're talking about ways that women have essentially been tortured over the course of history.
It's kind of, I mean, it's a laugh to keep from crying sort of thing, really. I mean, I can't name one other book that has a comedic through line about marital rape. Can you, Meryl?
No, but you know, I haven't really looked as hard as I should have. And also it's the thing that we could contribute as only amateur historians. We could contribute trying to find the lighter side of horrible stuff.
And also, I mean, once you laugh at something, you defang it. I think that's important.
Yeah.
Meryl Marco and Megan Keister are the authors of the audiobook, The Indignities of Being a Woman. You could find it at Audible. Meryl and Megan, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Well, thank you so much.
Yes, thank you, thank you, thank you.
Appreciate it.
Coming up, the venerable country swing band Asleep at the Wheel hits the half-century mark.
Southern California, the home of Hollywood, Dodgers, Disneyland. Sometimes it feels like paradise. But any second now, that could change. Because a big earthquake is coming.
This will happen. There's no likelihood of it not happening. We are not stopping plate tectonics.
When the earthquake hits, our world will be shaken. So what can you do to prepare? I'm Jacob Margolis, host of KPCC's new podcast, The Big One, your survival guide. Listen in Apple Podcasts.
Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Asleep at the Wheel has been making country western swing music for nearly 50 years. And at this point, they've carried on a tradition which started in the 1930s, longer than the genre's creator, Bob Wills, the king of western swing.
Take me back to Tulsa. I'm too young to marry. Take me back to Tulsa.
Asleep at the Wheel founder Ray Benson and the band's fiddler and singer Katie Shore visited The Frame recently to talk about the band's latest album, New Roots. It features originals written by both Shore and Benson, as well as a few cover songs by Guy Clark and Johnny Cash. Unifying it all is a love for the roots of American music.
My name's Katie Shore, and I'm the female vocalist and fiddle player for Asleep at the Wheel.
And I'm Ray Benson, and I've led this band for 48 years, down some strange paths.
Now I'm a feller with a heart of gold and the ways of a gentleman, I've been told.
It was 1969, and I was in college and was going to be a film director and then decided to play music. I've always played music since I was a child performer. Played folk music, rock and roll, jazz, but anything, whatever. And I said, I want to start a American roots band. It plays the music that it seems to be forgotten.
Smoke, smoke, smoke that cigarette. Puff, puff, puff.
And if you puff yourself to death.
30s, 40s was our inspiration. On the western side, Bob Wills and the Texas Playboys and many others, Moon Mullican. And then what Asleep at the Wheel's morphed into over the years has been a fiddle-based swing band. Here is one of the fiddlers and one of the and mouth trumpet players.
That's right.
I'm so high and so dry. I'm sailing in the sky.
Yes, my first fiddle contest was probably when I was 7 years old. And growing up in Texas, my granddad played the fiddle and used to play for us at home, and I really loved it. And so there was a fiddle community in Fort Worth, and the contest scene was a part of it. I won one in Seguin
one
time. Probably Boil the Cabbage Down.
Oh. Let's see if we can't get those fiddles one more time and Boil the Cabbage Down.
Her brother played fiddle too, so it was just you and your brother both played fiddle?
Yep, the two of us. And I started a little before him, but our fiddle playing is rooted in those tunes more than anything. You learn Red Wing, you learn Milk Cow Blues, you know, starting off on the fiddle. There's a lot of the crossover from the western swing that ends up in those, you know, tunes that you learn for the fiddle contest as well.
It's your friendly king of western swing, and time to ride that transcribed musical trail with Bob Wills and the Texas Playboys. And here are the Texas Playboys on the Lone Star Rag.
You know, it's a funny story that I've told. It's not funny, but I met Bob Wills. We went up to Dallas to meet him. He was making a record called For the Last Time. He was in a wheelchair, and we walked in the studio, and they said, Mr. Wills is asleep at the wheel. And he was really, really ill. And they said, he's very tired. We're taking him back to his motel, and you can talk to him tomorrow. And they took him to his motel, and he had a stroke and went to a coma. And 2 years later, we were playing the Longhorn Ballroom, which was the Bob Wills Ranch House in Dallas, and he died that day. All I care about for Asleep at the Wheel is that what we put on the on a record is good material done well.
Well, I wish I was in Austin. At the chilly part of bar, drink and mad dog margaritas and not caring where you are.
I liked this music when I was 19, and it wasn't what was cool. I just think there's always a segment of the population that is attracted to different than mainstream music, and this, we're certainly a unique band.
It's true, and I think the grooves, I think the music, and, you know, even though we're, this record is a little bit of an evolution of some of that, you know, a little more eclectic as far as roots go, but I think that not only does the music speak for itself, but I think their band is younger these days, and I think that people our age that see us up there really taking it seriously, and I think that just having good energy is what's attractive maybe the most, and this music is fun and lighthearted.
She just turned 30. When I started the band in 1970, started recruiting players, I could not find a fiddle player of my age. Now I am the luckiest guy because I get to find fine fiddle players. When I was looking for the singer, I had a little club in Austin, and I was looking on YouTube because we sometimes would post what was on the stage.
It's 2 a.m. and I'm back again in this sleepy town.
She had she got a gig there. Didn't pay much, did it?
Didn't pay much. I'm not sure I made any money after paying the two guys playing.
And I saw it. I went, who is this girl? Because there's a quality to her voice that is in between, you know, Billie Holiday and a Western Swing singer, and her voice. And then she picked up the fiddle, and I was like, oh gosh, she plays fiddle too.
I grew up listening to Asleep at the Wheel, and that was one of the things what I laugh. My mom told me when I was a kid I wanted to play the kind of music you clap your hands and stomp your feet to.
You know, this is music that was developed in the 30s, refined and changed through the years, but it's still alive right now.
People will still get up and dance in the aisles, which we love so much. It's hard to sit still to this music.
I got 7 nights to roll. And that's all we have for this week. The Frame is produced by Oscar Garza, Darby Maloney, Monica Bushman, and Jonathan Shiflett, with help this week from Julia Paskin. And our engineer is Valentina Rivera. I'm John Horn. Have a great weekend. We'll meet you back here on Monday.
At the old dance hall. Wednesday at the Roadhouse Inn. Thursday at the Lion's Den. Friday at the Chatterbox. Sunday, everybody rocks. 7 nights.